Welcome to the Democracy Paradox Podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the Democracy Paradox.
For the last 4 years, I have tried to do an episode where we revisit the state of democracy in the world. So far, the prognosis has never been good. Whether I talk to Freedom House or the VDEM Institute, the diagnosis is usually the same. Democracy remains in decline around the world. However, I still like these episodes because they give us a chance to catch events or trends that fly under the radar. This year, I had the opportunity to talk to Yana Gorikovskaya a few days before the release of the Freedom in the World report. Yana is the research director at Freedom House and one of the lead authors of this year's report titled The Mounting Damage of Flawed Elections and Armed Conflict. Our conversation explores a few of the places where Freedom saw its largest declines, but also a few where we saw positive improvements. We also discuss some of the ongoing trends as well as the ways they have evolved over the past few years. The podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute was founded by Guillermo O'Donnell, one of the giants of democratic thought more than 40 years ago. It continues to sponsor research on democracy and human development. Check them out at kellogg.nd.edu. You'll find a link in the show notes to their website. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, or would like to discuss ways to partner with the podcast, please send me an email to jkempf@democracyparadox.com. But for now, here is my conversation with Yana Gorikovskaya. Yana Gorikovskaya, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Yana, every year when Freedom House comes out with its new report, I usually think that it's just going to be an overview of what I already know, because I feel like I'm pretty dialed in to what's happening around the world. I feel like I'm paying pretty close attention to how it affects democracy. But every year, there's quite a bit within the report that actually catches me off guard and surprises me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, countries that declined a lot more than I would have expected them to. Some countries that had gains that I hadn't really been focused on. And this year, the big surprise to me was Nagorno-Karabakh. I was familiar with what was happening there, but it didn't click in my mind how big of an impact that was in terms of human rights, in terms of civil liberties, in terms of democracy within that enclave. It just didn't register how big of a story that was. And to be honest, I don't remember most of the news sources that I digest really focusing much at all on that. And yet, that's really the headline territory slash country in this report because of such dramatic decline in the territory. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there and why it was so significant?
Yeah, so Nagorno-Karabakh, I think, gets overlooked a little bit because it is an enclave. It's been subject of a dispute between Azerbaijan and Armenia, sort of, well, since the fall of the Soviet Union, but even, you know, going back in time before the formation of the Soviet Union, it's populated, or it was populated, by ethnic Armenians, and it's been under pressure from Azerbaijan, where the territory was kind of officially part of Azerbaijan originally. It's been under pressure by Azerbaijan for a long time. It kind of escalated in the last year, first with the blockade of the only corridor that connected the enclave to the outside world, and therefore was how people received food and medicine, kind of all the necessary supplies. And so that was blockaded for 9 months by activists, but not really. It was sort of government-backed, really in an effort to try and force people to leave. And then that escalated into a very short but significant military attack in the fall, which then resulted in all the population, which is about 120,000 people, leaving the territory en masse. And they left mostly for Armenia. And in Freedom House, we assess territory separately from countries. We use a kind of a criteria that isn't about taking sides in a conflict. It's not really about recognizing sovereignty or anything like that. This is really about assessing people's lived experience of rights and freedoms. And if that's significantly different from any country that exercises control or hopes to exercise control. And so that's why we assess Nagorno-Karabakh separately from Azerbaijan or Armenia. And on the basis of this seizure of the enclave, and then as a result, not only did the people leave, the government then announced that they actually had an elected government, and the government announced that they would totally sort of cease to be on January 1st of this year. So that seizure resulted in the biggest score decline that we've registered this last year, which is 40 points, and the territory moved from partly free to not free. It has a -3 score now.
Yeah, it went from being a country that was somewhat in the middle of the scale that Freedom House provides, it's a 100-point scale, to being the absolute worst of the worst this year, which is really shocking that there hasn't been more attention and more focus on the region despite such a dramatic score decline when you guys look at it much more systematically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what else gets missed, I think, is the wider story here, too, which is, first of all, there's kind of two sides. One is that people who live in territories are often subjected to a lot of rights violations, in part because they don't have access to an elected form of government, mostly. This isn't the case in Nagorno-Karabakh. As I said, they actually had an elected government, but many territories don't. And so without a way to hold their leadership accountable, people's rights are just really vulnerable. And that gets overlooked because we don't pay a lot of attention to territories. The second thing is that Nagorno-Karabakh, like a lot of other territories, is also sort of at the whims of authoritarian powers. So in this case, you have Azerbaijan. And what happened in the aftermath, as I said, the enclave has been under pressure from Azerbaijan for a long time. Azerbaijan is also an authoritarian country. It's been led for a long time by Ilham Aliyev, who's been the leader for over 20 years now. And he subsequently really made a big show of the seizure and how this was the kind of historic return of the land. And then he called a snapped election that he won, largely based on this anti-Armenian sentiment and the victory over Nagorno-Karabakh. So territories are kind of duly important because one is that people's rights and freedoms are severely restricted in many territories. And second, that they are often subject to authoritarian pressure in a really substantial way that other countries or places in the world don't really feel.
Another example of that that's almost the reverse situation is what's happening over in Gaza right now, where the people of Gaza are governed under an authoritarian government, but it's a democratic country that is really creating pressure on that region after the horrific terrorist attacks that happened on October 7th. Can you talk a little bit about how the lack of democracy and the lack of freedom within Gaza creates the situation that allows for the dynamics that we see happening there?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, in many territories, people don't have access to an elected form of government. And that's certainly true of the Gaza Strip. You know, there haven't been elections there for well over a decade now. People live under what is essentially an authoritarian government that is also a terrorist organization. And that has impacted not only rights and freedoms inside the Gaza Strip, but also for Israel, right? Because Hamas and other military groups have engaged in attacks on Israel, obviously on October 7th, but also well before October 7th as well. One of the challenges that we face in assessing even big developments with the report is that once a place has reached a certain level that's very low on the scale, as the Gaza Strip was and continues to be, it's actually very hard to register even large-scale kind of conflict. So we did this year, the Gaza Strip and Israel both had a 3-point decline in their scores. But in general, when you already don't have an elected form of government, when you already don't have freedom of expression, when you already don't have a lot of these rights and freedoms, each indicator is only on a 0-4 scale. So there's very little that we can kind of maneuver with. But nonetheless, we did register a decline in Gaza Strip. It had to do with the destruction of property, of businesses, also the almost complete seizure of work by international NGOs. And on the side of Israel, we've seen a long-term decline in Israel's democracy on various factors. But this year specifically, we registered a decline in physical security, which was directly related to the October 7th attack. And we did something similar when the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started. There was a decline in physical security. But we also registered a decline on judicial independence and due process. And those two things have something to do with the Gaza Strip, but mostly have to do with what's happening in the West Bank and what's been happening in the West Bank for a really long time. Due process declined because Israel holds Palestinians in detention for a really long time, and the court system is really backlogged. People don't receive trial in a timely way. Children are subjected to military prosecution in Israel. And judicial independence has gone down partly because of the Netanyahu administration's, you know, stated and then carried out efforts to diminish judicial independence. But also, you know, we heard a lot about the various laws that were passed, but also in practical ways by just not appointing judges, essentially, like, you know, slowing down the process of judicial appointments so that the whole system kind of grinds to a halt, which, of course, then escalates the problems with due process because you don't have judges to sit in court.
Gaza and the West Bank, I think, pose a really difficult problem because Israel has made the case that they don't really have a negotiating partner in those territories. But part of the reason why they don't have a negotiating partner is because nobody really knows what the people in those territories really believe or really feel, because we haven't had elections in those areas for more than a decade, particularly in the Gaza Strip. I mean, they did elect the leadership of Hamas into power in 2007. But that's been a really long time.
And also part of a coalition, right? Not as a single kind of governing party too.
Yeah, yeah. And there's no sense of how people feel today. I've heard reports that there's polls that Hamas only has a 30% approval within Gaza today. If that's the case, I mean, elections would bring entirely new leadership to power. But even if they didn't, just knowing what the people actually want in those territories would give us a much clearer sense of what the negotiations should actually be like. It's difficult to negotiate when you're talking to people that are tyrannically governing the territory rather than actually representing the people.
Yeah, and I think that that's such an important point. And it kind of brings us to what's happening this year in 2024, right? This giant year of elections, which we've heard so much commentary about. And a lot of the commentary is about what these elections will mean for democracy, right? Some of the biggest, most populous democracies in the world are going to the polls, whether that's the US or India or Indonesia. But what does it also mean for peace, right? I think the point with the Gaza Strip is really excellent because without an elected government, without a government that truly represents, or at least, you know, maybe not perfectly represents, but represents in some way and is accountable to the people, a lot of things are imperiled: rights, democracy, freedom, certainly peace. And so I think that's another kind of challenge as we go into this year of widespread elections. It's not just about preserving democracy. It's also laying the kind of foundation for peace, essentially.
So this was yet another year where we've seen freedom in the world continue to decline. It's the 18th consecutive year. I keep thinking that we're going to see a year where there's a small rebound just because there should be a regression to the mean, but it never happens. I mean, it's been 18 years. Why does freedom in the world continue to decline year over year?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, we came close last year. There were 35 countries that declined, 34 countries that improved. A lot of that was, I would say, the reversal of, you know, undue restrictions that had to do with COVID, essentially. You know, we may be surprised this year in terms of if elections are administered well, if they're competitive. I'm not very optimistic given the election in Bangladesh, the election in El Salvador. These were not free and fair contests. These contests had a lot of problems. So there are different kind of drivers of decline in freedom, and they change from year to year. I would say a long-term decline, you know, last year was our 50th anniversary, so we dug a little bit through the data and we tried to figure out which indicators seem to drive the decline or which types of countries seem to drive the decline. We found kind of two things. One is that freedom of expression has really driven the decline. And I think that makes sense because we try and look at not only freedom of expression in the sense of media freedom, but also private expression, so private discussion. And a lot of that has been repressed or constrained through what we see going on online, right? And the spread of digital surveillance, spyware, hacking, things like that, that has really made people's private expression, put that in danger. And to put that in context a little bit, there used to be very few countries where our indicator on private discussion was at a zero, in part because these are places like, you know, you'd have to think about like Stasi Germany or something like that, where you had a dense, widespread network of informants who were really like sitting in cafes and listening to people. But that's not the same in the era of the internet. And so if you look at a place like Russia, which just hit zero on the private discussion indicator, this is about restricting people's digital speech largely, which is how a lot of people have conversations, right? Whether that's public or private conversations. And so the proliferation of digital tools to control speech has really had a serious impact on freedoms and has been one of the drivers, I would say. So that's on kind of looking at the trends. In terms of countries, I would say that when we break apart the free, partly free, and not free categories of countries, the biggest decline has been in not free countries. So when we give you the statistic of 18 years of decline, that's true, but most of the decline has been contained in not free countries. So essentially, it's poorly performing countries becoming worse over time and significantly worse over time. So that's kind of where the issue lies. Like just on the elections indicator, you know, we measure how competitive, free and fair executive and legislative elections are. And the numbers there have increased just in the last 20 years of countries that hit absolute zero on that. So that means that they don't have free and fair elections. And you can see the reasons behind some of this. You know, some of the drivers are just rigged elections, like the election in Azerbaijan, the upcoming election in Russia. And some of these things are like coups, which we've also seen a huge spread of in the Sahel. I mean, Niger was the second largest decline this year after Nagorno-Karabakh. So there's a few drivers here. One is freedom of expression declining. One is just not free countries becoming worse over time, and really democratic institutions being stripped of their substance.
Another trend I noticed in this year's report was that the past 2 years, we've seen fewer countries with declines, but we've also seen fewer countries with gains. Like we only had 21 countries with gains. We had about 52 with declines. That's not that much farther off from past years, but other than last year, that's less than going back to what, 2010? So, I mean, does that say anything to you that maybe things are stabilizing somewhat?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. So one is that our lived experience, especially with like so much news and consumption, is that it feels like things are changing all the time, right? Everywhere. But in reality, when you sit back and you think about how things have changed, the vast majority of countries prohibiting things like war or coups or things like that, the vast majority of countries don't swing from end to end rapidly over time. And there's this other factor that I was talking about. With the not free countries getting worse over time, our scale ends at zero on indicators, right? And so when countries come to the zero on a given indicator, there's nothing else we can register. Obviously, our, you know, narrative reports for the countries include recent changes and we try and illustrate those. But in terms of the absolute score, the bottom is zero. And so we deliberate really hard about making those changes. But once a country reaches zero, right, Afghanistan, for instance, on the freedom of the media score this year reached zero. That's it, right? If journalists in Afghanistan are further repressed, which they may be, there's very few left. They're extremely censored. It's very hard to work from the country. For all intents and purposes, we've decided that there is no media freedom in Afghanistan. But that doesn't stop something worse happening later. But it's very hard to indicate that in a score. So I think that's also part of the issue. You know, the fact that most countries stay stable over time, the vast majority of countries stay stable over time, even though we spend a lot of our time talking about these large movers. That's one thing. Another one is that if you accept that it's the not free countries that are driving a lot of the decline and that those countries are slowly kind of zeroing out on scores, then you'll see less and less movement just going forward in time.
At the same time, I would have thought
that would mean that we would have seen a year of gains by now, that we would have gotten to a point that a lot of countries couldn't go any lower. And so the number of countries in decline was so minimal that the number of countries that were improving could finally outnumber the countries that had declined. But we haven't seen that. It's been 18 years. We still haven't seen the bottom completely drop out yet.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, look, the challenge in writing this report is often looking for bright spots, right? And I want to be clear that there definitely are. Even this year, which has been, by objective measures, pretty bad for freedom, we had unlikely gains for the rights of LGBT people in Africa, in the Baltics. We had, speaking of elections, a great election in Liberia that was competitive and well-administered and, you know, showed a country's kind of recovery from war, essentially. We had gains in Fiji. These are positive signs, and it's easy to overlook them, I think. But the trend over time has sort of illustrated a long-term decline, and I remain optimistic. Again, the countries that are in the free category tend to move the least and tend to have the fewest declines. And the other thing that we see is that the category is fairly sticky. There's a possibility that countries move out. So this year, Ecuador moved from free to partly free. But that's sort of an outlier. Most countries remain in the free category. And that's not true for partly free and not free countries. Those countries are really sort of volatile in their scores and move up and down quite a bit. Like, for instance, Thailand has the most status changes of any country in our data set. If you think about the history of Thailand, it's pretty clear why that is, right? It's rapid swings from elected government to coups, back to elected government, back to coups. But that's not the norm. That's not the norm for countries around the world.
Ecuador is an interesting one because it was last year, or maybe it was the year before that, that it moved from being partly free to free. Now it's moved back down to partly free. I mean, it's kind of the exception that proves the rule because it's right in that gray zone where 1 or 2 point change means that it has a complete status change. I was more interested in the countries that were some of the biggest gainers and the fact that most of the time, those large gains that we see, those largest gains from countries, tend to be much smaller than the large declines. For instance, the big gains were in countries like Fiji that had a 7 point increase, Thailand had a 6 point increase, Nepal and Liberia had a 4 point increase. I mean, those are dwarfed by the declines in Niger, which was an 18 point decrease, and Nagorno-Karabakh, that was 40 point decrease. Why is it so much easier to see big declines in countries rather than big gains?
Well, I think my blanket answer to that is that once freedom and democracy is seriously imperiled, it is very actually hard work to recover and to rebuild. Positive process and progress is very slow. The more simplified answer is that wars and coups are immeasurably devastating to a country. And the other thing that we've seen is that they are devastating in the short term, which you see in the 1 year decline, but they're devastating in the long term too. So, you know, the other countries that we saw some decline in, although not huge decline, but continuing decline, were Burkina Faso, which had, you know, the year before 2 coups in a single year and as part of that Sahel belt of coups. We saw a continuing decline in Sudan, which had a coup and now has a civil war between military and paramilitary forces, which has displaced something like 9 million people, right? We had further decline in Myanmar, which had a coup followed by what is now essentially a civil war as the military tries to repress the armed opposition. So in the short term, when you just look year to year, these events cause huge declines because essentially, if you think about the way we measure freedom, right, it's a scale of political rights and then civil liberties. Once a coup comes into place and they suspend the government or they disband the government and then they ban all opposition parties and then they restrict all media and then they restrict all protest, it just hits across so many indicators that it creates this numeric kind of huge decline, which I think reflects what's actually happening on the ground. And then it has these longer kind of ramifications that continue to keep going as those rights get repressed further or kind of associated rights get repressed even more, right? Things like maybe they restrict movement because they don't want people to shift around or institute a curfew or something like that. On the other hand, when you have improvements, it's a slow process. And the other thing that we try to do is measure people's actual lived experience. And so not just sort of legal changes or the promise of laws. We really wait for the experience on the ground to change. And that means that when a new government comes into office and promises a slate of huge changes, we don't immediately say, great, that's a positive improvement. We wait for the actions to take place. And Fiji is actually a really good example of this because the positive election was in 2022. It wasn't in 2023. But we needed the year to see if the government would actually do what they said they would do. There was some question that the government actually wouldn't be allowed to take office. There were questions about how effective they would be. You know, there are all these issues. And so there's a gap in time between sort of the start of the process and positive improvement and the actual kind of positive improvement that you see in scores. And you're right that often numerically, it's much harder to improve in a kind of a large way than it is to decline.
It also makes a philosophical point that it's a lot easier to break down institutions of the state than it is to rebuild them. It's not just tyrannical states that are the ones that are creating threats to freedom. Oftentimes, it's the absence of the state to be able to protect those rights and freedoms that's the bigger problem. In a lot of ways, the countries that are doing the worst, it's a lack of state capacity that they have rather than a state that's so powerful that it's threatening rights and liberties.
I think both are true. And, you know, another example of sort of non-state actors that are really threatening state institutions and democracy is what's happening in Ecuador. Ecuador had a well-administered election. It was a snap election. It was competitive, well-run. But it was incredibly violent. You had a presidential candidate who's assassinated 11 days before the vote. The rest of the candidates had to wear body armor. They limited their campaigning. People were afraid to go to the polls, right? So the effect of non-state violence on democracy and democratic institutions is huge. You know, another example of this is that Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, had an election last year. It was a competitive election. It was administered. I mean, there were problems, but relatively okay. But the threat of insurgent violence did keep some people away from the polls, and it did hinder the administration of the election. And it was supposed to be the most voters ever to participate in this election, the most young voters. And in the end, it had very low turnout. And that can imperil the long-term legitimacy of the elected government, right? Because they're elected by a very small proportion of the population in this hugely populous country that is also facing a lot of different problems. So I think criminal violence, sort of armed violence, is something that we don't talk a lot about because it's sort of not a classic democracy problem, but it's a really serious challenge to almost all democratic institutions, and especially democratic institutions in countries with low state capacity. But it's a problem that builds on itself, right? Because violence degrades state capacity, and then countries become less able to deal with the violence, and their democratic institutions suffer as a result. And then it kind of is a cascade of these problems, essentially.
Yeah. And sometimes the solutions end up degrading democracy even further, like what we've seen happen in El Salvador with Bukele.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an excellent example. Bukele was reelected just in February. He is undeniably very, very popular. He's very popular because El Salvador was facing a crisis in terms of violence when he took power. And he solved that crisis by instituting a state of emergency that essentially eliminated due process and the rule of law in the country. You can be detained anywhere, anytime, for any reason, for an arbitrary amount of time, as long as the government decides that that's appropriate. And as a result, you have 70,000 people in detention in El Salvador. And violence, you know, no huge surprise, violence has gone down. Mobility has improved for people. You know, businesses are able to operate. All those things are true. And it's made Bukele incredibly popular. Nevertheless, another major theme in this report is electoral manipulation. And Bukele engaged in quite a bit of electoral manipulation to win this election. I mean, just to participate in this election, you know, El Salvador has a constitutional prohibition against consecutive presidential terms. if you've been paying attention, Bukele has now begun his second consecutive presidential term, in part because in 2021, he fired all the judges off the Constitutional Court and appointed judges that then reinterpreted the Constitution to allow him a second consecutive term. But more than that, you know, his party also used their control of the national legislature to change the rules governing elections the same year the election was being held to reduce the number of seats, thereby making districts much bigger and actually making it much harder for opposition parties to win. So despite the fact that he came in, he used sort of these restrictions on freedoms to get control of the problem of violence, which made him incredibly popular. You know, he didn't stop with those rights violations. He went on to change the rules around elections to keep himself in power, essentially. So definitely, you know, this is an example of sort of dangerous leaders coming to power through elections and then manipulating the rules once they're in power.
Yeah, I think Bukele really demonstrates one of the paradoxes of authoritarianism, which is that he's found ways to increase state capacity while at the same time weakening state institutions.
Right, because he's centralized power, right? And in some ways, that's incredibly effective sometimes for some policies, right? Being able to make decisions in a really centralized way can be effective in solving problems. I mean, institutional paralysis of the kind that we see in the US, but also that we see in places like Peru, is devastating. It can really hinder any kind of problem solving, any kind of policy advances. In Peru, it pitted the president against the legislature, which has now resulted in the attempted autogolpe 2 years ago, and then subsequent this power struggle between supporters of the president and supporters of the legislature. But you see this kind of dysfunction really hinder policy and democratic process. On the other hand, when elected officials, elected executives, and it's mostly the executive that you see this in, presidents especially, then try to solve that problem by concentrating all the decision-making power in their own hands, that has a lot of different effects, including the weakening of all other checks and balances institutions, including the legislature, but also, I think, significantly in lots of countries, courts. And so then that creates these ripple effects that weaken democracy going forward, because once this person leaves office, someone else takes office, but they take office in this newly empowered pyramid of the executive, and then they get to decide on whatever policies they want to decide. And maybe they weaken, you know, elections to allow themselves to continue in that office. So, yeah, I think both sides of the coin are really problematic for democracy.
I want to step back to a theme that you were discussing just a moment ago. We were talking about how there's a lot of violence in a lot of these countries, a lot of things happening, and you were discussing quite a bit about the different coups that have happened, particularly in Africa, but we've also seen them in places like Myanmar. Why is it that we're seeing so many coups in recent years? Because for a long time, it felt like there was sort of an anti-coup norm, that the declines in democracy were coming from executive takeovers, declines in checks and balances, but we weren't seeing militaries actually physically seize power like we saw during the Cold War. Why is it that we're seeing more of those once again?
So Niger was the sixth country since 2020 in the Sahel to experience a coup. You know, other countries, Mali, Guinea, Chad, Sudan. It actually also was not the only country last year to have a coup in that region of Africa more broadly. Gabon also saw a coup, and I think you heard less about Gabon's coup because, well, there are a lot of other things happening, but also because Gabon is a deeply authoritarian country in which a sort of authoritarian president who was the head of a family dynasty that's been in charge of the country for something like three decades was replaced by his own presidential guard. But interestingly enough, immediately following an election that he won. So, you know, basically the military said, no, that election doesn't count. We're now in charge. The coup in Niger received a lot more attention because it deposed a democratically elected government, and one that was, I think, widely popular. President Bazoum was in close contact with the US and Europe. From his detention, he managed to write an op-ed talking about how bad things were and what was happening. So there's definitely an increase in coups, and I think it's worrying that it is geographically concentrated, in part because we're seeing a simultaneous weakening of the regional institutions. So ECOWAS is the one I'm thinking of here, which tried to pressure the coup leaders in Niger to reverse their action. The problem, though, was that ECOWAS was openly opposed by the leaders of Burkina Faso and Mali, who were themselves coup leaders, and who openly said that if ECOWAS, you know, mustered a military force to try and depose the military junta in Niger, that they would send their own troops. And so then, you know, you have a regional organization that has to balance whether or not they want to risk a war, essentially, armed conflict in the region. So I think that might go some way to kind of answering the question of why this norm is degrading. I think in part because the cascade of coups has its own self-reinforcing effects, right? So you have more leaders who have taken the step to replace the elected government. Then they offer support to each other. And both Mali and Burkina Faso also postponed these promised elections they said they were going to have. And they start to support each other. So, you know, I think in part this goes back to something that Freedom House has been, I think, concerned about for a long time, which is the unified force of undemocratic governments banding together and opposing democratic norms. There is something to be said about how dangerous that is and how dangerous it is when it's geographically concentrated, when it's close in time, and when it openly challenges regional or international organizations as well.
So I was reading about the upcoming election in Belarus, and it's obviously not in this year's report because it hasn't happened yet. But I found it fascinating that it's a multi-party election that does not have a genuine opposition party. All of the parties support Lukashenko, who is nominally an independent. He rises above political parties, apparently. How do you think about those type of elections? Because in the past, what we'd been demanding were for multi-party elections where people would have a choice. But people are being given choices, like genuine choices, except for they're not meaningful choices at the same time. It seems to be really an evolution of what autocratic elections really are.
Yeah. And I mean, that still, I think, contributes to upholding the norm of elections. So the fact that it's not a one-party state, the fact that they haven't, even though, you know, for all intents and purposes, it is a one-party state, or I should say Belarus is a no-party state. There's no legitimate political parties in Belarus that are competing in elections. There is whatever Lukashenko and his sort of corrupt structure, however they want to exercise that power. The political parties are mere labels. But these things still matter. So I'm thinking, you know, one of the elections that was in the report was the Cambodian election. You know, Hun Sen, who's been in power for 30 years, won that election with the Cambodian Communist Party. It was not a genuinely competitive election, even though there were, I think, 16 other parties on the ballot. So people had a choice, except for the fact that the most popular opposition party, the Candlelight Party, was not allowed to compete. You know, it was not allowed to compete based on the fact that they couldn't produce their original registration paperwork, and they couldn't produce the original registration paperwork for the Electoral Commission because it had been seized by the police in a raid, you know, 5 or 6 years ago and never returned to them. Obviously, a completely manufactured reason, but they were excluded from the election. But that didn't make the election uncompetitive. It made it effectively uncompetitive, but not kind of on paper uncompetitive. But the fact that Hun Sen has been in power for 30 years and still went through the trouble of finding a legal mechanism. And let's be frank, Cambodia imprisons political opponents, you know, left and right. So he didn't need this kind of reason. But he went through the trouble of finding a legal kind of loophole to exclude the Candlelight Party so that he could win and then he could appoint his son as his successor. So that tells you something, too. He's still committed to some form of at least kind of faux or facade democracy. So I think that regular multi-party but non-competitive elections tell me that free and fair elections are a norm that is still universal and that authoritarians still hold on to.
So the report paints a very bleak picture overall. I think we've discussed that a few times. But you did mention that there are signs of optimism, and you mentioned a few of those. Can you go more in depth in one of them that really stood out to you, one of them that meant a lot to you personally?
In making this report and doing our assessment, we spent a lot of time talking about the election in Thailand this year. And as you mentioned, it's one of the countries that had one of the biggest point improvements. And that was the result of a competitive election process. Now, we have to be realistic. The party that eventually formed government, Putai, was not the winner of the election. It had the second most votes, which is still significant. The Move Forward Party did not form government, was not allowed to form government, despite the fact that it won the most plurality of votes and therefore plurality of seats. And so it should have been allowed to form government. But because Thailand has this unelected Senate and it has a mechanism that results from the previous coup and the fact that the military was able to write the constitution, the Senate approves whoever the nomination for prime minister is. And so it's the combined vote of the two houses that is needed. And without the Senate's approval, it's impossible to become prime minister, even if you win the majority of elected seats, right? And so that's what happened to the Move Forward Party. And then subsequently, their leader has a lot of legal kind of limitations and ways to prevent him from taking power. He's now no longer the leader of that political party. So when you step back and you think, okay, so there was a competitive election, but in the end, the party that was the choice of the people did not form government. That seems pretty undemocratic. But I think if you take the longer view, there's actually a lot of positive movement because the party that did form government, Putai, was the party that was kept out of forming government in the previous election. And it's still not a military party. It's kind of in the opposition wing. The fact that the people of Thailand participated in this election, that they debated the issues, that they had choice, that they had genuine choice, that both these parties were able to compete, that there were a lot of young people who were involved, that the Move Forward Party campaigned openly on reforming the constitution, on lessening the power of the military, which is a hugely taboo subject in the country. You know, all of these things were able to happen. And yes, in the end, the result was controlled through kind of these undemocratic constitutional provisions. Nevertheless, this is movement forward. This really is progress. This is competition, competitiveness. This is pluralism. This is really important stuff, especially in the context of Thailand, which is a unique country and has a unique history. I'm really happy to see that. I think that is genuinely a positive development.
So every time I see a report like this come out, whether it's from yourself or from Varieties of Democracy or Polity, there's a lot of criticism. Sometimes the criticism is just about the very idea of trying to compare how democratic or how free countries are, just the very idea that you can't really put a number on how democratic a country is. But then there are also other criticisms out there about the specifics of the report, such as if India has a major decline, people from India are oftentimes ones to complain. If a country in Western Europe has a decline, sometimes people who live there might complain. Sometimes if you don't have a decline and you actually have an improvement, people will complain that democracy is still being held back and that there isn't really meaningful gains. Your report is different than some of the other measures of democracy and freedom out there because I feel like it's very public-facing. You guys do an amazing job with all of your reports in terms of making them understandable to the general public and a wider audience. Can you just kind of explain what the purpose of a report like this is, not just for people who are really dialed into democracy, but also in trying to communicate these ideas to a broader public?
Well, as I said, you know, so we're now in our 51st year, Freedom in the World. The first report was issued in 1973. And the benchmark that was being used, how we created the methodology that we still use today, it's actually based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The yardstick that we're using is something that an international mechanism that countries around the world have agreed to, have committed to. And it's not one about measuring the performance of a government, right? It's not about kind of parsing our right-wing policies better, our liberal policies better. You know, it's not about parsing policy outcomes. It's really about sort of fundamental freedoms and whether or not people get to experience those. And all of that is also geared to trying to explain to people in the general public what's happening around the world and putting people's experience really in the context of this kind of global picture, right? And so I see part of the work, like we started this conversation by saying that, you know, there's this shocking thing that happened in Nagorno-Karabakh, but I would bet that a lot of people don't know where Nagorno-Karabakh is, right? And so part of this report, at least for me, is about talking about places like Nagorno-Karabakh or Fiji or Bhutan and putting that in context to what's happening in places you have heard of, like the Gaza Strip or Thailand or Niger, you know, or Sweden or the UK. And it's all of that. It's providing that global comparative picture and putting it in the perspective of people's lived experience so that people understand when they read the news and when they kind of absorb the news, what's happening and giving them that broader picture.
Well, Jana, thank you so much for joining me today. The report, once again, it's Freedom in the World, the Mounting Damage of Flawed Elections and Armed Conflict. That's the title of the executive summary. Again, it's always an impressive report. Thank you so much for being one of those to author and kind of spearhead the project. It's, again, incredibly impressive. Thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening.